Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 30 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, we feature the first part of George Miller's interview with the writer and broadcaster Michael Bywater. Today, Michael talks to George about his early days in journalism at Punch and his book Lost Worlds.
My name is George Miller, and I'm very pleased to say that my guest in this programme is writer, broadcaster and journalist Michael Bywater. Michael was born in Nottingham and educated at Cambridge, where he switched from medicine to English and was also an organ scholar. He first made his name as a writer on Punch, under the editorship of Alan Corran, where in the 80s he created the character of the egregious barge pole, a sort of unbridled manifestation of the spirit of the age. We'll be hearing more about him in the course of this interview. The Barge Pole Chronicles were subsequently published as a book, and in the last decade Michael has published two more acclaimed books. In 2004, Lost Worlds, which Tatler called a gorgeously written and barking mad catalogue raisonné of, well, all kinds of stuff that we've lost. And Howard Jacobson wrote, "What makes Bywater so good is the exactitude with which he remembers. It's Bywater's intellectual grief that gets me every time." Lost Worlds was followed 2 years later by Big Babies, a riposte to what Bywater saw as the increasing infantilization of contemporary culture, with its endless safety notices, admonitions and instructions that rob us of our sense of ourselves as autonomous, reasoning, reasonable adults. The reviewer in The Scotsman called Bywater a wonderfully sharp and witty writer whose sentences sing and dance, whose fluffiest paragraphs are held up by a steel core of thought. This interview is in two parts. In the first part, we talk about Michael's life and career up to the publication of Lost Worlds. Before we begin, I should probably disclose that I used to be Michael's editor when I was a publisher, and also confess that, although Michael does indeed have a dog, the dog you will hear woofing in the background on a couple of occasions is in fact mine. I began by asking Michael if he reckoned he'd had a good childhood for a writer.
The idea of a good childhood for a writer is a great one. I mean, if you could patent it, you could sell it. Mothers, do you want your child to be a writer? This is what you have to do. I don't think there is such a thing. I had a childhood. I mean, I was a bit of a cuckoo to my parents. They were pretty straightforward, and I was quite peculiar kid with odd interests, cycling around the countryside at the age of 12 with my friends to get into country churches and play the organ. I mean, that's pretty odd. I think there's a common factor, though, not with all writers, but certainly with an awful lot, of the idea of loss quite early on. And in my case, it was, well, there were two things that happened. One I barely remember, which was a girl was adopted. She was a baby. And they said, "Here's your new sister." And I was enchanted by her. And then 2 weeks later, she mysteriously vanished again. I never did get to the bottom of it, but certainly that was a fairly significant thing. And I think probably leaves you with an unspoken feeling that you might get sent back too. And the other thing was, when I was about seven, we lived in this sort of absolutely magical house in the foot of the Castle Rock in Nottingham. It was a sort of late Georgian, early Victorian house with a walled garden. Lovely. And we moved. We moved out to a fairly barren bit of the countryside. I think of it now as this sort of expulsion from Eden, but at the time I just felt expelled, and I think most of life subsequently has been about an attempt to get back in, if you like. And I think there are an awful lot of people in this trade who have the same experience, a sense of being excluded, of being taken away, of not quite belonging, and so you tell stories to try and work yourself back in, whether they're... I mean, the most extreme example is a thing I did for many years on Punch called Barge Pole, a column called Barge Pole. I had this character called Sir Hieronymus Barge Pole, who was an exaggerated version of me. He was me without the diffidence or lack of confidence. He just sort of blasted his way around the world. He was partly based on what I'd like to be and partly based on Hunter Thompson. Yeah, wish fulfillment, a Freudian would say. But here was this character you make up who is at ease, who hasn't been expelled, has a sense of his absolute entitlement. And there's a certain amount of making up for your own deficiencies in it.
And by the time you went to Cambridge, it was as a medical student and also an organ scholar.
No, I thought I could combine being an organist, because Cambridge is an organist's paradise. I know this probably means nothing to anyone, but it's a spooky instrument that gets under your skin. And all these wonderful ones in all the colleges didn't work. And actually, I didn't have the bent for medicine. What I liked was, I realised with hindsight, the narrative of medicine. I remember reading a piece by a clinician called Peyton, beautifully written case study of a drug for high blood pressure. And he called it Hexamethonium Man. And it's written in the most glorious way, talking about how he was seen. He was never unpleasant to be near because he didn't sweat, and his handshake was always dry. And eventually he said, he will slowly expire, as the universe will itself, of a sort of heat death, growing colder and stiller until he stops. And I thought, that's wonderful, this is medicine. Which, of course, it wasn't. It was all about learning muscles and stuff and embryology and physiology, which I was no damn good at. So I changed to English. That was a bit of an eye-opener. Not least because you were being, well, not paid, but you were being told that what you were to do was read. That's the crucial thing, I think, for anyone who wants to be a writer is, oddly, not writing, it's reading. Because writing anything is your building an artifact, and it's made out of words. And so you need to get to know not just the artifact you're trying to build, but you need to know better, you need to know how the words work. Probably even down almost a rhetorical theory. If you don't know, you might not know the words for it, if you don't know the difference between metonym, sorry about the dog, but every writer needs to have a dog. It's important, we can't think without a dog. If you don't know the difference between metonym and metaphor, you're going to get into trouble. You don't have to know that that's what they're called. Metaphor is comparing things based on similarity. Metonym is comparing things based on proximity. They're the two mainstays of all writing for the last 2,500 years.
And by that stage, though, did you, as well as reading and taking the machine to bits, did you also have a sense, beginning, of what you could do with the power of words?
No. I had absolutely no idea that I would be any good at it. I still wonder whether I will be any good at it or not. I don't think you ever get to the stage where you have a sense of mastery. I think you get to the stage where you have a sense of your own competence. You can build something which will be, you know, will be watertight or will fly or will hold a dinner for six people or whatever it may be. You know, you can work your tools and not cut yourself and break the thing. But I don't think you ever get a sense of mastery, and I certainly didn't have it then. I had to learn how to do it. And primarily, it was by reading. By finding somebody whose way of doing it you admired and simply copying, imitating. I'm told this is really bad and you can concentrate on getting your own style. I disagree hugely with that. It's like music. Composers learn. Bach learned by copying out endlessly. The physical act of with pen and ink and paper, copying out other people's compositions. And in that process, somehow seeing, it was almost as though where the pen nib went on the manuscript paper fed some idea of structure and theory and form and content and manner into his brain up through his arm.
Do you remember which writers back then were the ones that particularly fed your imagination and allowed you to see what could be done with words?
The usual suspects. I was particularly interested in drama at the time, which is what I went on to do as a postgraduate, because you're dealing with a very formalised, special way of how the human voice works. I did my thesis on Beckett and Pinter and how they used the rhythms of the music hall and speech patterns of the music hall. Yes, I did. He never. You know, repetitions. I said to him, I'll put the cat out. I said, I'll put the cat out. Anyway, I've been upstairs. I've been upstairs. Dickens, absolute master of the sort of caricatured melodrama of the human voice using language in composition. How somebody's words can build their character. Because that's really all you've got in drama. And as I said, the usual suspects, Beckett, the trilogy, Molloy, Malone, Dies in the Unnameable. Language disintegrating. And War, probably the greatest stylist of the last 150 years, I think. P.G. Woodhouse. Brilliant. Then I got interested in how it could be funny. And I read everything S.J. Perelman had written. I now find him extraordinarily kind of overwrought. And the great stylist I think I really, really admired at that time was Alan Corran. A few years later, I was lucky enough to be sort of taken up as his kind of protege and heir apparent, and working with an absolute genius at close quarters who let nothing go past. It was a tremendously good sort of apprenticeship.
It's interesting that all the writers you mentioned, albeit in very different ways, are funny. You know, even Beckett, there's a humour in it. Was that something that you sort of were consciously gravitating towards? Were you aware that you too were funny and that you wanted to be funny?
God, wanted to be funny is awful. It sounds like somebody turning up in a revolving bow tie and a red nose and sort of novelty spectacles and moustache kit. No, but I...
Well, wanted to make people, you know, had an ability to make people laugh, and you enjoyed being able to achieve that.
We have no word for that sort of thing in the English language which is not derogatory. The worst one is humour. Oh, yeah, no, as a humorist, a sideways glance at the vagaries of the world, side-splittingly funny. Yeah, I laughed till I wept. Yeah, very, very whimsical. Humorous is a term of absolute abuse, and probably rightly so, because it shades too easily into the arch and the nudge-nudge and the Eric Idle sort of sleazy nudge-nudge, wink-wink, follow my meaning, get my drift, say no more. Yes, I was, because I think wit, actually, because at the same time I was also fascinated by the metaphysical poets, particularly John Donne. That's wit in a different sense, but it's all about stress-testing language to almost to the extreme. And in the metaphysicals, in John Donne, it's right out on the surface. I wonder, by my troth, what you and I did till we loved. Were we not weaned till then? Weaned. An extraordinary word to use. The nocturnal on St. Lucy's Day. If I an ordinary nothing were. An ordinary nothing. It's a symphonic, extraordinary poem, but the first thing that hits you and keeps hitting you is the language. Come dung, my love, and let it grow. My America, my newfound land. And everything is going in there in the form of words. Same with the other form of wit, the wit designed to... We used to make jokes about it. You know, oh, I think now is the point at which I will deploy an adjective rendered hilarious by its completely unexpected context. I remember going to a humour conference once in Cardiff. Honestly, by the time the morning session had finished, you just wanted to kill yourself. It was terrible. But yeah, wit in both senses. Wit in the sense of getting a laugh, and wit in the sense of an extraordinary play upon the language, using metonym, using metaphor, colliding words together. Language is at the forefront of it in both cases. So I suppose I was interested in language more than the actual storytelling side of it, which is not surprising, coming from music through theatre into writing on the page. Yeah, it is going to be the orchestration, if you like, the virtuosity of the orchestration that first catches your eye, and you think, I wonder if I could do that.
And a strong sense of voice, too, because, again, with your theatrical background, the sense of something being delivered or performed, even if you're still reading on the page, but the sense that it could be delivered or performed, and that's something which seems to me an attribute of your writing. You can imagine it being spoken aloud. You can imagine the inflections of the voice from the way that you put it down on the page.
You hope that the reader can. It was something that Corran was particularly hot on, and he wasn't just a merry prankster. He was a man of the most acute intelligence and sensibility, and he decided that it would be more fun to make people laugh than to make them admire the precision of his observations. And we talk about this at great length, and always we came back to the same thing, with what counts with words on the page first is rhythm. If the thing doesn't scan, if you can't almost conduct a piece of writing, I mean prose here, it's not working. You can screw up irremediably a sentence by a word with the wrong kind of metrical quantity. That sounds incredibly pretentious, but it's not. There's got to be a pulse in the writing. And I suppose in that sense, yes, there is a voice. And voices in different sorts of English. We're incredibly lucky, though, it's getting flattened out now. You've got so many different ways of doing English in voices. My mother's family were from South Wales, and the old cadence of the language, see, oh, it's lovely. And you would hear straight into the... Where's Uncle Ivor? Oh, I don't know. Don't ask me. Up the Nant, stacking bloaters. Well, could you ask me? Oh, could I ask me? All right, jump on my back and I'll sing you Chinese hymns, was one of the... Oh, lie down, I'll fan you. And the song, the rhythm of all this sort of thing. Yeah. My other grandmother was Euphemia May Price, née Valence of Morningside and Jenners, a very proper Edinburgh lady. So I heard all these voices. People who say, oh, I can't read Beckett. And Beckett took great steps himself to distance himself from Irish English by writing in French and then retranslating it back. Waiting for Godot, one of the greatest plays in the language, was originally En attendant Godot. He wrote it in French. But people who say, I can't read Beckett, you say, read him in a Dublin accent and the whole voice is transformed. So we moiled and we toiled. And eventually, one or other of us gave up, or we got tired, or we just stopped. And thought, oh, this is love, it's a mug's game, and tiring into the bargain. If you read that in your inner ear, in the tones of a, I don't know, a tax inspector from Worthing, it's not going to sound like anything. There is a human voice behind every bit of writing, and the writing that I really like is the one where you can hear the voice, it brings the voice with it, and if one gets an inch of that. Sometimes it's extraordinary. My dead best friend, Douglas Adams, when he wrote, it was the most agonising process of cutting and cutting and reshaping and throw away and cutting and cutting, and to do a sentence would sometimes take, you know, a day's work. The labour he put in, everyone thinks he was lazy, he wasn't, he was a perfectionist. The labour and the energy and the sweat and the literally tears that went into his stuff. But the extraordinary thing was that when you read it, or when I read it, because I knew him very well, I can hear his voice. I can hear his voice as if we were in conversation. So out comes the human voice, unmediated, unmodulated, and then it goes to this extraordinary process of crafting and hacking and shrinking and blowtorching and all the rest of it. And at the end of it, you get somehow back the individual human voice you started with. It's got to sing. If it doesn't sing, it's no damn good.
So when you started at Punch, how much freedom did you have to go in directions that you wanted to pursue?
Total freedom. We knew what we were trying to do. Then nobody ever articulated it. We were on tight deadlines. We were out once a week. Monday morning, we'd have the conference where everyone would bring their ideas and bid for the things we wanted to do. And
maybe for people who haven't, you know, who don't remember Punch, you could just sort of characterise it.
God, it's like saying you knew Jesus. What was he like? Lovely boy. Lovely boy. Very nice, good man that loved his mother. Punch was a magazine. It was a weekly, and again, it called itself humorous. Chock full of jollity. It was pretty good under Alan Corn. It was a funny magazine that took not so much a satirical, but a kind of wearily despairing view of human vagary. We had one thing we loved doing in that. It's my favourite. You'd take a little clipping from the papers, a bit like, you know, they do at the end of the news quiz, and you'd spin off on it for 1,500, 2,000 words. It could be anything. I remember when the Archbishop of York, I think he was at the time, or possibly Durham, was misquoted as saying the resurrection of our Lord Jesus Christ was a conjuring trick with bones, when actually what he'd said was the resurrection obviously was more than a conjuring trick with bones, otherwise it would have served nothing. But he was generally accused of blasphemy and all these sort of dreadful things. At which point, lightning hit the tower of either York Minster or Durham Cathedral, whichever one he wasn't at. Got the wrong cathedral. Which, as Kingsley Amis said in Lucky Jim, illustrated the tendency of... illustrated this incredible, implacable swiftness of divine vengeance and also its tendency to mistake its target. And so we got this, and I thought, I'll have that. Don't know where you're going. Spun off, and it's still one of my favourite things, 2,000 words... of two insurance loss adjusters turning up to have a word with God. And God comes out from behind his throne, which is sort of toppling a bit, with a Swiss army knife, and he's wearing corduroy trousers and looking a bit worried. And they say, you have the pleasure of addressing God? Yes. The God? Yes. Supreme creator and mover and ruler and sustainer of the universe, invisible and visible. Yeah, listen, call me Keith. And off they go. And it was only sometime afterwards, rereading it, I thought, hang on, I've actually, this comic god is actually just an absolute picture of my father, who was called Keith. And I just, this kindly, slightly bemused, hoping for the best, chap who happens to have been lagged with the job of creating and sustaining the known universe. So, yeah, you do things like that. Alan loved obscurity. It's like, you know, a four million-year-old toad has been found in a well, and off he'd go, and the toad would turn out to be Michael Gove, except Michael Gove probably hadn't even been conceived then. God, that's something I'd like not to have been present at, which I wasn't, so it's lucky. So it was just designed. It was supposed to be funny. And I even now say that with a faint sort of feeling that it's a trivial, awful thing, even though we now live in an age where nothing can be done on television unless it's presented by a bloody comedian. We still think comedy is a lower form. There's the whole thrust behind the name of the rose. You know, Aristotle wrote his Poetics, but have we lost his Comedics? And comedy is coarse and wrong and vulgar, etc., etc. I think actually it's much more difficult form, particularly just in writing, because if it's not, look, Homer Simpson's great, well, Homer Simpson's many great lines, it's funny because it's true. Well, yeah, if it's not true, it's not funny, but you have to push it almost to the point where it is no longer true, but not quite over that edge.
Was that what Barge Pole enabled you to do? You mentioned him earlier, the comic Barge creation Pole. Did it let you go push to the limit?
Probably beyond the limit, where it just actually became revolting. Barge Pole was the man that I and probably all men would really like to be. He just did what he chose.
And this is in the 1980s, isn't it?
Yeah, he ran through the 80s, which was a terrible decade, although at least we didn't have the current government in power, so it would have been even worse. No, it was a dreadful decade. It was the decade of big shoulders, of Wall Street, of Filofaxes, of Del Charles, I'm on my way. Taxi! The advertisement for Audi. You know, it was the dawn of the yuppie and probably the beginning of all the trouble we've had since. So there was plenty to go at. Mad egotism, mad consumerism, the scramble after pointless empty wealth, cheating. Awful, awful. It was the first sort of decade where we had the balkanization of cultural fashions. You know, that you were a Red Braces man, or you were an Aramis Devin man, or you know, we were defining ourselves much more than ever before, I think, by the external. So there was a lot to do, and Barge Pole was just this pig in the middle of it. Foul-mouthed, drug and drink-addled, wearing cracked sunglasses and a stained linen suit, you know, with a kind of joint in his gob and a needle in his arm, lurching from crisis to crisis. And in the end, the line was, he said, be like me, be the hero of your own life, which none of us ever quite managed. But there was Bartle, and for a time I had the chance to put on this this character for 10 years or so, I suppose.
And did it come easily? Once you'd got the voice, you channeled him quite easily? And as you were saying, the whole culture was giving you lots of material to draw upon. So did it just all click?
Oh, yeah. You get kinder as you get older, because you realise that pretty soon you're going to be terminally screwed and you're going to be dependent on people not wanting to think. Not thinking, oh, look, here's Bywater. He doesn't look very well. He looks a bit thin. He looks a bit yellow. I wouldn't be surprised if his liver's gone. Let's kick his head in. You want to say, oh, poor chap, pick him up, give him a good meal, let him have a go on your wife, he'll like that. That's what we sort of hope for. But then when you're a young buck and you're immortal, because you don't stop being immortal actually until you're 43, which is the general year at which one day you wake up having had the dream. And the dream is the one that says, no, sorry, mate, it's real. It's actually going to happen. You are going to die. Which tends to concentrate the mind. But when you're in your 30s, you think, yeah. And the voice came. It took about 2 or 3 goes to get it right. And then, bump, off we were.
Do you ever wonder what happened to the old chap?
Oh, good God. You see, you shouldn't have said that. That's because you're an editor and you go for the jugular. And no, but as soon as you said that, the whole 120,000 words opened out in front of me. What does happen to a totally anarchic, cocky, self-indulgent, charming, completely original, mad, correct, funny, psychotic misfit like Barge Pole? God, it's a fascinating thought, isn't it? What happens one day he wakes up and he knows he can't do it anymore, and he's got the yeah, he's got the line of cocaine, and he's rolled up his, and he suddenly realizes it used to be a £50 note, and now it's a £5 note. And can you toot cocaine through a £5 note? And anyway, he's got too many nose hairs to get it in, and he's got his hands. Yeah, we're away. What's the last cry of the renegade?
You talked about as one grows older, you know, your style of comedy, your style of writing, your attitude to life changes. And there's a very, very big difference between the tonality of the Chronicles of Bargepole, which you published as a book, and the book Lost Worlds, which I was fortunate enough to work with you on.
Yeah.
And some people, I still hear some people say, oh, there was that book, Lost Worlds, it was a collection of Michael Bywater's columns. And that always annoys me. But I suppose the mistake is excusable in the sense that they both had the same title. So just tell me what you were doing in the book. Because the columns were basically a weekly.
That was a weekly
riff.
Column I did again for 10, 12 years for The Independent on Sunday, until one day all columns come to their end, and actually it had been reaching its end for a while before the editor finally thought, hello, Bywater's writing bollocks, better sack him.
And that must be an anxiety that columnists live with every week, the thought that this could all come to an end and you've got to keep producing the goods and trying to intuit what is actually wanted.
Or can
you put that from your mind?
No, I used to fly a lot, and there's the old saying, dog again, the old saying, there are two sorts of pilots, those who've landed with the landing gear up and those who haven't landed with the landing gear up yet. It's going to happen one day. It's a, you know, motorcycle race, you know, you're going to come off and break your head or something one day. You don't think about it. It's just one of those things that happens. And actually, generally speaking, a column will persist slightly beyond its sell-by date, because the authors of it's in the groove. The editor can rely on at least that 1,400 words coming in on time every week. And so nobody looks. Then suddenly somebody does look and says, hang on, this has lost its edge.
So tell me then about the book, which was a different idea entirely from the column.
The book came originally as a serious thing that somebody had asked Mary Beard to write, or she'd thought of writing, and she decided that she couldn't. It was going to be about, I think it was about loss, but it was particularly antiquity and things that we no longer have in antiquity, like Nero's thing on baldness, and Suetonius, the great biographer of the 12 Caesars, had written a celebrated history of the great whores, and things that we all wish we still had.
So the known unknowns, as
the known unknowns. Yeah, they then came to me, and I thought, well, that's really interesting, but actually, it started widening out, and eventually it became. The word is the lemma, the lemmata, the little sort of bits you write in the margin while you're doing a mathematical theorem, and little other things spin off. And the lemmata took over the whole book, which were little tiny things that weren't here anymore. Things that I remember, or my father remembered, or other people remembered. Things like proper bank managers with steepled fingers and a suit and a, you know, 18-piece 48-ounce wool suit, like a sort of carapace. They were like, the old bank manager was like a Dalek. That thing that poked out the top of his suit wasn't him. Inside, there was this little sort of withered, irradiated and disappointed sort of lobster thing. You were very, very disappointed in the state of your account, Mr. Bywater. He would have said, you're not disappointed. You are not disappointed. You know, if you were sacked, you'd be disappointed. You're not disappointed. You're just pretending. Proper doctors who didn't tell you anything. No, 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 old chap. We're just going to open up and have a poke around and see what's going on. Fries, five boys, chocolate. A tram called the Ripley Bang Bang. Baby's bottom tobacco. Smooth as a baby's bottom. You couldn't have that anymore because it would sort of be a paedophile tobacco. And anyway, nobody smoked. All these little things. Some big, some small. I remembered my grandfather talking about a patient, and they were all doctors, as I said, whose wife of 60 years had died, and he was a bit worried because this chap had shown no emotion. Oh, I'm fine. No, I've got things to do. And then a few months later, his dog or something died, and the neighbours rang my grandfather up and said, you've got to come round, he's in a terrible state. And sure, he was wailing and howling, and life was over. And my grandfather said, I thought at first it was really very strange that he could be in this state over his mangy old dog when his wife, you know, the partner of his whole life, raised not even a sniffle. And he said, and then I realised that the dog was a loss of the right size for him to get his arms around. Losing his wife was too big for him to be able to encompass and grieve. Losing the dog was the right size, and he could howl for both of them at the same time. So, yeah, it doesn't sound like a barrel of laughs, but then it is sort of odd little miniatures, if you like. If I'd had more wit and set myself up like Alain Robrier or the... what's the American chap who does those little miniatures? Trout fishing in America. Richard Brautigan. Tiny little miniatures. But I didn't have the wit to do that. I just wrote them down.
There was a lot more to it than just lamenting things that have gone for the sake of it. It wasn't a nostalgia book, was it?
Absolutely not nostalgia. It's not a book of nostalgia, it's more a book about nostalgia. But instead of saying this is what nostalgia is, we first of all observe that the necessary condition for nostalgia is the idea of the nostos, which the classical antiquarians in Greece would have referred to. You find it in the Iliad, and of course more in the Odyssey, the return. So no. It's more about nostalgia. What is it about nostalgia? And we ended up, because as you say, you were editing it, we ended up finding this path through the complexities. I remember getting to the end of it, and it ended with a little reflection on death and absence. I was writing about my two best friends who died, John Diamond and Douglas Adams. And I had no idea that this was coming at all. And I ended the thing with this little thing of, you know, the dead zone, lost life. And then, as you do, I read it through. I hadn't seen where this was going. And suddenly there is actually an absolutely clear arc in this book, where it starts and where it ends. And it does actually, it's almost as though this, some magical force has overlaid this almost sort of radiant arch over what I thought was a fairly workmanlike compendium of little pieces on things. Maybe it's the unconscious mind guiding your thoughts. A lot of writing comes out of the unconscious. I think anyone will tell you that. You sit down, you write, and you think, where the hell did that come from?
That was Michael Bywater in conversation with George Miller. You can find out more about Michael on his website at www.michaelbywater.com. And that concludes episode 30, which was recorded and produced by George Miller. Coming up in episode 31, poet Jane Draycott reads from the medieval poem Pearl and from her modern translation of it, and biographer Carol Angier shares the surprises, challenges and pleasures of beginning to write poetry. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.